shirt, carrying a small package in one hand. Looking up and down the block, Tom was saying something into the cell phone, then put it in his pocket. He said to us softly, "You all know what to do." Actually, I missed that rehearsal. Tom said, "Keep in mind, it could be an innocent delivery man. Don't get too physical, but get him down and get the cuffs on him." I wondered what happened to the goo gun. I felt my face getting a little sweaty. The doorbell rang. Scott waited about 5 seconds, then reached for the knob and opened the door. Before the door blocked my view, I saw Scott smiling as he said, "Something for me?" "Mr. Wiggins?" said a voice with an accent. "No," replied Scott. "I'm just house-sitting. You want me to sign for that?" "When will Mr. Wiggins be home?" "Thursday, maybe Friday. I can sign, it's okay." "Okay. Please sign here." I heard Scott say, "This pen doesn't write. Come on in." Scott backed away from the door, and I couldn't help but think that if Scott were really a house-sitter, he'd soon be dead and stinking in the back room while Asad Khalil waited for Mr. Wiggins to return home. A tall, swarthy gentleman stepped a few feet into the living room, just clearing the door, which Edie kicked shut. Even without being briefed, I knew what was going to happen next. Before you could say abracadabra, Scott grabbed the guy's shirt and yanked him into the waiting crowd. Within about 4 seconds, our visitor was pinned, face down with me on his legs, Edie's foot on his neck, and Tom and Scott putting the cuffs on him. Kate opened the door and signaled with a thumbs up to whomever was watching through binoculars. Then she ran down the walkway to the van, and I followed her. We checked out the van, but there was no one in it. A few packages lay scattered on the floor, and Kate found a cell phone on the front seat, which she took. Cars started appearing out of nowhere, screeching to a halt on the street in front of the house as agents jumped out, just like in the movies, although I don't see the need for the screeching. Kate said to them, "He's cuffed." The garage door had opened, I noticed, and Roger and Kim were on the lawn now. Still, no neighbors around. I had the unkind thought that if this were a movie being made, the crowds would be uncontrollable as people shouted out offers to be an extra. Anyway, as per SOP, the stakeout people all got back in their vehicles and began leaving to resume their watch of the house so as not to scare off any accomplice that might show up, not to mention upsetting Mr. Wiggins if he came home, or his neighbors who might eventually notice. Kate and I ran back into the house where the prisoner was now lying on his back, being closely searched by Edie and Scott as Tom stood over the guy. I looked at the man and was not overly surprised to discover that it wasn't Asad Khalil. Chapter 48. Kate and I looked at each other, then at everyone around us. No one looked real happy. Edie said, "He's clean." The man was sort of blubbering now, tears streaming down his face. If anyone had any doubts that this was not Asad Khalil, the blubbering clinched it. Roger and Kim were in the living room now, and Kim said she was going to radio the stakeout units and tell them that the delivery guy wasn't our man and to stay alert. Scott had the guy's wallet and was rummaging through it. He asked the guy, "What's your name?" The man tried to get himself under control and sobbed out something that sounded like a mixture of phlegm and snot. Scott, holding the guy's driver's license with his photo, said again, "Tell me your name."
"Azim Rahman."
"Where do you live?" The man gave a Los Angeles address. "What's your birth date?" And so on. The guy got all the driver's license questions correct, which led him to believe he was about to be sent on his way. Wrong. Tom started asking him questions that weren't on the driver's license, such as, "What are you doing here?"
"Please, sir, I have come to deliver a package."
Roger was examining the small package, but didn't open it, of course, in case it contained a little bomb. "What's in here?" Roger demanded.
"I do not know, sir."
Roger said to everyone, "There's no return address on this." He added, "I'll put this out back and call for a bomb disposal truck," and off he went, which made everyone a little happier. Juan entered the living room, and by this time, Azim Rahman was probably wondering why all these guys with FBI windbreakers were hanging around Mr. Wiggins' house. But maybe he knew why. I looked at Tom's face and saw that he was worried. Knocking around a citizen, native-born or naturalized, was not good for the old career, not to mention the FBI image. Even knocking around an illegal alien could get you into hot water these days. I mean, we're all citizens of the world, right? On that thought, Tom asked Mr. Rahman, "You a citizen?"
"Yes, sir. I've taken the oath."
"Good for you," said Tom. Tom asked Rahman a bunch of questions about his neighborhood in West Hollywood, which Rahman seemed able to answer. Then he asked him a lot of other questions, sort of civics 101 stuff, which Rahman answered not too badly. He even knew who the governor of California was, which made me suspicious that he was a spy. But then he didn't know who his congressman was, and I concluded he was a citizen. Again, I looked at Kate, and she shook her head. I was feeling pretty low at that moment, and so was everyone else. Why don't things go as planned? Whose side was God on, anyway? Edie had dialed the home phone number that Mr. Rahman had given her, and she confirmed that an answering machine answered Rahman residence, and the voice sounded like the guy on the floor, despite the man's present emotional state. Edie did say, however, that the phone number on the rapid delivery service van was a non-working number. I suggested that the paint on the van looked new. Everyone stared at Azeem Rahman. He knew he was on the spot again and explained, "I just start this business. It is new to me, maybe 4 weeks." Edie said, "So you painted a number on your van and hoped that the phone company would give you that number? Do we look stupid to you?" I couldn't imagine how we looked to Mr. Rahman from his perspective on the floor. Position determines perspective, and when you're on the floor in cuffs with armed people standing over you, your perspective is different from that of the people standing around with the guns. Be that as it may, Mr. Rahman stuck to his story, most of which seemed plausible, except the business phone number bullshit. So by most appearances, what we had here was an honest immigrant pursuing the American dream, and we had the poor bastard on the floor with a red bump on his forehead for no other reason than the fact that he was of Mideastern descent. Shame, shame. Mr. Rahman was getting himself under control, and he said, "Please, I would like to call my lawyer." Uh-oh. The magic words. It's axiomatic that if a suspect doesn't talk within the first 5 or 10 minutes, when he's in shock, so to speak, he may never talk. My colleagues didn't pull it off in time. I said, "Everyone here except me is a lawyer. Talk to these people." "I wish to call my own lawyer." I ignored him and asked, "Where are you from?"
"West Hollywood."
I smiled and advised him, "Don't fuck with me, Azeem. Where are you from?" He cleared his throat and said, "Libya." No one said anything, but we glanced at one another, and Azeem noticed our renewed interest in him. I asked him, "Where did you pick up the package you were delivering?" He exercised his right to remain silent. Juan had gone out to the van, and he was back now and announced, "Those packages look like bullshit, all wrapped in the same brown paper, same tape, even the same fucking handwriting." He looked at Azeem Rahman and said, "What kind of shit are you trying to pull?"
"Sir?"
Everyone started to browbeat poor Rahman again, threatening him with life in prison, followed by deportation, and Juan even offered him a kick in the nuts, which he refused. At this point, with Mr. Rahman giving conflicting answers, we probably had enough to make a formal arrest, and I could see Tom was leaning in that direction. Arrest meant the reading of rights, lawyers, and so forth, and the time had come to do the legal thing. It had actually passed a few minutes ago. John Corey, however, being not quite so concerned with federal guidelines or career, could take a few liberties. The bottom line was that if this guy was connected to Asad Khalil, it would be really good if we knew about it. Now. So having heard enough of Mr. Rahman's bullshit, I assisted him from the sitting to the supine position and sat astride him to be sure I had his attention. He turned his face away from mine and I said, "Look at me. Look at me." He turned his face back to me, and our eyes met. I asked him, "Who sent you here?" He didn't reply. "If you tell us who sent you here and where he is now, you will go free. If you don't tell us quickly, I will pour gasoline all over you and set you on fire." This, of course, was not a physical threat, but only an idiomatic expression that shouldn't be taken literally. Who sent you here? Mr. Rahman remained silent. I rephrased my question in the form of a suggestion to Mr. Rahman and said, I think you should tell me who sent you and where he is. I should mention that I had my Glock out now, and for some reason Mr. Rahman had put the muzzle in his mouth. Mr. Rahman was properly terrified. By this time, the federal agents in the room, including Kate, had stepped away and were actually looking the other way, literally. I informed Mr. Rahman, I'm going to blow your fucking brains out unless you answer my questions. Mr. Rahman's eyes got very wide, and he was starting to comprehend that there was a difference between me and the others. He wasn't sure what the difference was, but to help him toward a complete understanding, I gave him a knee in the nuts. He let out a groan. The thing is, when you start this course of action, you better be real sure that the guy whose rights you may be infringing upon knows the answers to the questions he's being asked, and that he will give you those answers. Otherwise, contract agent or not, my ass was hanging out. But nothing succeeds like success, so I need him again to encourage him to share his information with me. A few of my colleagues left the room, leaving only Edie, Tom, and Kate to witness that Mr. Rahman was a voluntary witness whose cooperation was not coerced, and so forth. I said to Mr. Rahman, look, asshole, you can go to jail for the rest of your fucking life or maybe get the gas chamber as an accessory to murder. You understand that? He wasn't sucking on my automatic any longer, but still he refused to say anything. I hate to leave marks, so I shoved my handkerchief down Mr. Rahman's throat and pinched his nostrils shut. He didn't seem able to breathe through his ears, and he began thrashing around, trying to get my 200 pounds off his chest. I heard Tom clear his throat. I let Mr. Rahman turn a little blue, then took my fingers off his nose. He caught his breath in time to get another knee in his nuts. I really wished that Gabe were there to instruct me on what worked, but he wasn't, and I didn't have much more time to mess around with this guy, so I held his nostrils again. Without going into details, Mr. Azim Rahman saw the advantage of cooperating and indicated his willingness to do so. I pulled the handkerchief out of his mouth and jerked him up into a sitting position. I asked him again, who sent you here? He sobbed a little, and I could see that he was very conflicted about all of this. I reminded him, we can help you. We can save your life. Talk to me or I'll put you back in that fucking van and you can go meet your friend and explain things to him. You want to do that? You want to go? I'll let you go. He didn't seem to want to go, so I asked him again, who sent you? I added, I'm tired of asking you the same fucking question. Answer me. He sobbed a little more, caught his breath, cleared his throat, and replied in a barely audible voice, I do not know his name. I only knew him as Mr. Perlman, but... Perlman? Like in Jewish? Yes, but he was not Jewish. He spoke my language. Kate already had a photo in her hand, and she shoved it in his face. Mr. Rahman stared at the photo a long time, then nodded. Voila! I wasn't going to jail. I asked, does he look like this now? He shook his head. He has now glasses, a mustache, his hair is now gray. Where is he? I don't know. I don't know. Okay, Azim, when was the last time you saw him and where?
I met him at the airport.
Which airport?
The airport in Santa Monica.
He flew in?
I don't know.
What time did you meet him?
Early, 6 in the morning.
By now, with the rough stuff out of the way and the witness cooperating, all 6 FBI folks were back in the living room, standing behind Mr. Rahman so as not to make him too nervous. I, having secured the witness's cooperation and trust, was the person who would ask most of the questions now. I asked Mr. Rahman, where did you take this man?
I took him. He wanted to drive, so we drove.
Where?
We drive up the coast road.
Why?
I do not know.
How long did you drive? Where did you go?
We drove to nowhere. We drive perhaps an hour or more. Then we return here, and we find a shopping mall that was now open.
A shopping mall? What shopping mall?
Mr. Rahman said he didn't know the mall because he was not from around here. But Kim, who was from the Ventura office, knew it by Rahman's description, and she quickly left the room to call the troops. But I had no doubt that Asad Khalil had not stuck around the mall all day. I backtracked to the airport and asked Rahman, "You met him with your van?"
"Yes. At the main terminal."
"No, at the other side, in a coffee shop." Further questioning revealed that Rahman met Mr. Khalil at the general aviation side of Santa Monica Airport, leading me to believe that Khalil had arrived by private plane. Made sense. Then, with time to kill until dark, the two Libyan gents took a nice scenic drive up the coast, then got back to Ventura, where Mr. Khalil expressed a desire to do a little shopping, maybe get a bite to eat, and maybe buy a few souvenirs. I asked Rahman, what was he wearing?
A suit and a tie.
Color?
A gray, a dark gray suit.
And what was he carrying? Luggage?
Only a bag, sir, which he disposed of as we drove. I drove him into a canyon.
I looked around. What's a canyon?
Tom explained.
Sounded silly to me. Back to Azim Rahman. I asked him, could you find this canyon again?
I don't know. Perhaps. In the daytime, I will try.
You bet you will. I then asked him, did you give him anything? Did you have a package for him?
Yes, sir. Two packages. But I do not know what they contained.
Well, everyone there probably took the same course I did in something called crateology, so I asked Mr. Rahman, describe the packages, the weight, size, all of that. Mr. Rahman described a generic box about the size of a microwave oven, except it was light, leading us all to believe it may have contained a change of clothes and perhaps some documents. Crateology. The second package was more interesting and scary. It was long. It was narrow. It was heavy. It did not contain a tie. We all looked at one another. Even Azim Rahman knew what was in that package. I turned my attention back to our star witness and asked him, did he also dispose of the packages or does he still have them?
He has the packages.
I thought a moment and concluded that Asad Khalil was now decked out in new duds, had new identity papers, and had a sniper rifle broken down in some sort of innocuous-looking bag, like a backpack. I inquired of Mr. Rahman, this man sent you here to see if Mr. Wiggins was home.
Yes.
You understand that this man is Asad Khalil, who killed everyone on board that aircraft that landed in New York. Mr. Rahman claimed that he didn't make the connection, so I made it for him and explained, if you are helping this man, you will be shot or hanged or fried in the electric chair or put to death by lethal injection or put into the gas chamber. Or maybe we'll chop your head off. You understand? I thought he was going to faint. I continued, but if you help us capture Asad Khalil, you get $1 million reward.
Not likely.
You saw that on television, didn't you? He nodded enthusiastically, giving away the fact that he knew who his passenger had been. So, Mr. Rahman, stop dragging your ass. I want your full cooperation.
I am doing that, sir.
Good. Who hired you to meet this man at the airport?
He cleared his throat again and replied, I do not know. Truly, I do not know.
He then went into a convoluted explanation of a mysterious man who accosted him one day about 2 weeks ago at the gas station in Hollywood where Mr. Rahman actually worked. The man asked his assistant in aiding a compatriot who offered him $10,000, 10% then, 90% later, and so forth. Classic recruiting by an intelligence agent, maybe twice removed, of some poor schmuck who needed cash and had relatives in the old country. Dead end, since Mr. Rahman was not going to ever see this guy again to collect his 9 G's. I said to Rahman, these people would kill you before they would pay you. You know too much. You understand? He understood. They picked you out of the Libyan community because you look like Asad Khalil, and you were sent here to see if there was a trap waiting for him, not just to see if Wiggins was here. You understand? He nodded. And look at you now.
Are you sure these people are your friends?
He shook his head. The poor guy looked miserable, and I was feeling badly about kneeing him in the balls and almost suffocating him. But he'd brought it on himself.
I said, okay, here's the big question, and your life depends on the answer. When, where, and how are you supposed to contact Asad Khalil?
He took a long, deep breath and replied, I am to call him.
Okay, let's call him. What's the number?
Azim Rahman recited a telephone number, and Tom said, that's a cell phone number.
Mr. Rahman agreed and said, yes, I gave this man a cell phone. I was instructed to buy two cell phones. The other is in my vehicle.
Kate had that cell phone, which had a caller ID on it, and I assumed Asad Khalil's cell phone also had a caller ID. I asked Mr. Rahman, what is the telephone company for these cell phones?
He thought a moment, then replied, Nextel.
Are you sure?
Yes, I was instructed to use Nextel.
I looked at Tom, who shook his head, meaning they couldn't trace a Nextel call. In reality, it was difficult to trace any cell phone, though back at 26 Federal Plaza and 1 Police Plaza, we had these devices called Triggerfish and Swamp Box that could at least tell you the general location of an AT&T or Bell Atlantic call. Mr. Rahman's friends had apparently ignored the enticements and bullying of the big carriers and taken advantage of an unadvertised feature of a smaller carrier, a feature known in the trade as the Fuck the Feds feature. These people were not as stupid as some of their compatriots. Bad break for us, but there had been a lot of them, and this wasn't the last. It was time to make Mr. Rahman more comfortable, so Tom uncuffed him. Rahman rubbed his wrists, and we helped him to his feet. He seemed to have difficulty standing straight and complained about a pain in an unspecified area. We sat Mr. Rahman down in a nice, easy chair, and Kim went into the kitchen to get him a cup of coffee. Everyone was a little more optimistic, though. The chances of Azim Rahman bullshitting Asad Khalil into thinking everything was fine at the Wiggins house was pretty slim. But you never know. Even a smart guy like Khalil could be conned if he was obsessed with a goal, like murdering someone. Kim returned with a black coffee, which Mr. Rahman sipped. Okay, coffee break is over. I said to our government witness, look at me, Azim. Is there a code word you're supposed to use for danger? He looked at me like I'd discovered the secret of the universe. He said, yes, this is so. If I am as I am now, then I am to say the word Ventura in my talk to him. He gave us a nice example by using the word in a sentence like I had to do in school and said, Mr. Perlman, I have delivered the package to Ventura.
Okay, make sure you don't say the word Ventura, or I'll have to kill you.
He nodded vigorously. So Edie went into the kitchen to take the house phone off the hook. Everyone shut off their cell phones, and if there had been a dog in the house, he would have gotten a nice walk. I looked at my watch and saw that Mr. Rahman had been here about 20 minutes, which was not long enough to make Khalil nervous. I asked Azim, was there a specific time you were supposed to call?
Yes, sir. I was to deliver my package at 9 p.m., then to drive 10 minutes and make the telephone call from my van.
Okay, tell him you got lost for a few minutes. Take a deep breath, relax, and think nice thoughts. Mr. Rahman went into a deep breathing meditation mode. I asked him, you watched the X-Files?
I thought I heard Kate groan.
Mr. Rahman smiled and said, yes, I have watched this.
Good. Scully and Mulder work for the FBI, just like us.
Do you like Scully and Mulder?
Yes.
They're the good guys, right?
We're the good guys.
He was polite enough not to bring up the subject of me knocking his nuts around, as long as he didn't forget it. I said, and we will make sure you are safely moved to wherever you want to live. I can get you out of California, I assured him. I asked, are you married?
Yes.
Kids?
5.
I'm glad he had the kids before he met me. I said, you've heard of the Witness Protection Program, right?
Yes.
And you get some money, right?
Yes.
Okay. Are you supposed to meet this man after your telephone call?
Yes.
Excellent. Where?
Where he says.
Right. Make sure your telephone call leads to that meeting, yes?
I didn't get an enthusiastic response. I asked Mr. Rahman, if all he needed from you was to come here and see if Wiggins was home, or to see if the police were here, why does he need to meet you again?
Mr. Rahman had no idea, so I gave him an idea.
Because he wants to kill you, Azeem. You know too much, understand?
Mr. Rahman swallowed hard and nodded.
I had some good news for him, and I said, this man will be captured, and he will cause you no further trouble. If you do this for us, we will take you to lunch at the White House, and you will meet the president. Then we give you the money. Okay?
Okay.
I took Tom to the side and said softly, does anyone here speak Arabic?
He shook his head and said, never needed an Arabic speaker in Ventura.
He added, Juan speaks Spanish.
Close enough.
I went back to Mr. Rahman and said, okay, dial the number. Keep the conversation in English. But if you can't, my friend Juan here understands a little Arabic, so don't fuck around. Dial.
Mr. Azeem Rahman took a deep breath, cleared his throat yet again, and said, I need to smoke a cigarette.
Oh, shit. I heard a few groans. I said, does anyone here smoke?
Mr. Rahman said, you have taken my cigarettes.
I informed him, you can't smoke your own, pal.
Why may I not?
In case they're poison. I thought you watched the X-Files.
Poison? They are not poison.
Of course they are. Forget the cigarettes.
I must have a cigarette. Please.
I know the feeling. I said to Tom, I'll light one of his. Tom produced Azeem's cigarettes, not Camel's, and in an act of uncommon bravery put one in his own mouth and flipped Azeem's lighter. Tom said to Azeem, if this is poison and it harms me, my friends will...
I helped out and said, we'll cut you up with knives and feed the pieces to a dog.
Azeem looked at me. He said,
please, I want only a cigarette.
Tom lit up, took a drag, coughed, didn't die, and handed the cigarette to Azeem, who puffed away without dropping dead.
I said, okay, my friend, time to make your telephone call. Keep it in English.
I don't know if I can do that.
He nursed the cigarette as he dialed the telephone, flipping the ash into his coffee cup.
I will try.
Try hard, and make sure you understand where you have to meet him.
Rahman listened to the rings, which we could all hear. Then Azeem Rahman said into the telephone,
yes, this is Tannenbaum.
Tannenbaum?
He listened, then said, I'm sorry, I became lost.
He listened again, then suddenly the expression on his face changed, and he looked at us, then said something into the telephone. I have no idea what he said because it was in Arabic. He continued the conversation in Arabic, making helpless shrugging gestures toward us. But Juan was cool, pretending to listen, nodding, even whispering in my ear. Juan whispered to me,
what the fuck is he saying?
I made eye contact with Mr. Rahman, mouthed the word Ventura at him, and made a cutting gesture across my throat, which in Arabic or English or whatever is understandable. He continued his conversation, and it was obvious, despite everyone's lack of Arabic, that Mr. Khalil was putting Mr. Rahman on the spot. In fact, Mr. Rahman began to sweat. Finally, he put the cell phone to his chest and said simply,
he's asking to speak to my new friends.
No one said anything.
Mr. Rahman looked very distraught and said to us, I am sorry. I tried. This man is too clever. He is asking me to sound the horn of my van. He knows. I did not tell him. Please, I do not want to speak to him.
So I took the cell phone and found myself talking to Asad Khalil. I said pleasantly,
hello, Mr. Khalil?
A deep voice replied, yes. And who are you? It's not a good idea to give a terrorist your name, so I said,
I'm a friend of Mr. Wiggins.
Are you?
And where is Mr. Wiggins?
He's out and about. Where are you, sir?
He laughed. Ha, ha. He said, I, too, am out and about. I had turned up the volume and was keeping the phone away from my face, and I had seven heads around me. We were all interested in what Asad Khalil had to say, but also everyone was listening for a background sound that might be a clue as to where he was. I said, why don't you come to Mr. Wiggins' house and wait for him here?
Perhaps I'll wait for him elsewhere. His guy was smooth. I didn't want to lose him, so I resisted the temptation to call him a camel-fucking scumbag murderer. I felt my heart beating rapidly and took a breath.
Hello? Are you there?
I replied, yes, sir. Is there anything you'd like to tell me?
Perhaps, but I don't know who you are.
I am with the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
There was a silence then, and do you have a name?
John. What would you like to tell me?
What would you like to know, John?
Well, I think I know almost everything there is to know. That's why I'm here, right?
He laughed. I hate it when scumbags do that.
He said, let me tell you some things you may not know.
Okay. My name, as you know, is Asad, from the family of Khalil. I once had a father, a mother, two brothers, and two sisters. He then proceeded to give me their names and a few other details about his family, ending with, they are all dead now. He went on talking about the night of April 15th, 1986, as though it was still fresh in his mind, which I guess it was. He ended his story with, the Americans killed my entire family. I looked at Kate and we nodded at each other. We'd gotten that part right, though it didn't matter much anymore. I said to Asad Khalil, I sympathize with you, and I don't need your sympathy. Then he said, I have lived my life to avenge my family and my country. This was going to be a difficult conversation since we had so little in common, but I wanted to keep him on the line. So I used the techniques I'd learned in hostage negotiating class and said, well, I can certainly understand that. Now it may be time to tell the world your story.
Not yet. My story is not finished.
I see. Well, when it is, I'm sure you'd like to tell us all the details, and we'd like to give you an opportunity to do so.
I don't need you to give me any opportunities. I make my own opportunities.
I took a deep breath. The standard stuff didn't seem to be working. But I tried again.
Look, Mr. Khalil, I'd like us to meet, to talk in person, alone.
I would welcome the opportunity to meet you alone.
Perhaps we will someday.
How about today?
Another day.
I may come to your home someday, as I came to the homes of General Wycliffe and Mr. Gray.
Call before you come.
He laughed. Well, the asshole was toying with me, but that's okay. Part of the job. I didn't think this was going anywhere, but if he wanted to talk, that was fine. I said to him, how do you think you're going to get out of the country, Mr. Khalil?
I don't know. What would you suggest?
Asshole. Well, how about we fly you to Libya in exchange for some people in Libya that we'd like to have here?
Who would you rather have in jail here more than me?
Good point, asshole. But if we catch up with you before you leave the country, we won't offer you such a good deal.
You're insulting my intelligence. Good night. Hold on. You know, Mr. Khalil, I've been in this business for over 20 years, and you're the biggest scumbag, the most clever man I've had to deal with.
Perhaps to you, everyone seems clever. I was about to lose it and took a deep breath and said, such as having that man killed in Frankfurt so we would think it was you.
That was clever, yes, but not so clever.
He added, and I congratulate you on keeping the news people in ignorance.
Or perhaps it was you who was ignorant. Well, a little of both. Hey, for the record, Mr. Khalil, did you dispose of, I guess you'd say, anyone else we don't know about yet?
Actually, I did. A motel clerk near Washington and a gas station attendant in South Carolina.
Why'd you do that?
They saw my face.
I see. Well, that's a good... But the lady pilot in Jacksonville saw your face, too.
There was a long pause. Then Khalil replied, "So, you know a few details."
"Sure do. Gamal Jabbar? Yosef Haddad on board the airliner? Why don't you tell me about your travels and the people you've met along the way?"
He had no problem with that and gave me a nice rundown on his travels by car and plane, the people he met and killed, where he'd stayed, things he'd seen and done, and all that. I thought maybe we could get a fix on him if we could determine what false identity he'd used, but he burst my bubble and said, "I have a complete set of new identity, and I assure you I will have no problem leaving here."
"When are you leaving?"
"When I wish to leave."
He then said, "My only regret, of course, is not being able to see Mr. Wiggins. As for Colonel Callum, may he suffer and die in agony."
My goodness, what a prick. I got a little testy and said, "You can thank me for saving Wiggins' life."
"Yes. And who are you?"
"I told you, John." He stayed silent a moment, then said again, "Good night."
"Hold on, I'm having a good time. Hey, did I tell you that I was one of the first federal agents on board that aircraft?"
"Is that so?"
"You know what I'm wondering?
I'm wondering if we saw one another.
You think that's possible?"
"It is possible. I mean, you were wearing a blue transcontinental baggage handler's jumpsuit, right?"
"Correct."
"Well, I was the guy in the light brown suit. I had this good-looking blonde with me." I winked at Kate.
"You remember us?"
He didn't reply right away, then said, "Yes, I was standing on the spiral staircase." He laughed. "You told me to get off the aircraft."
"Thank you."
"Well, I'll be damned. Was that you? Small world." Mr. Khalil picked up the ball and said, "In fact, I saw your photograph in the newspapers. You and the woman."
"Yes, and your name was mentioned in Mr. Weber's memo that I found in your conquistador club. Mr. John Corey and Miss Kate Mayfield."
"Of course."
"Hey, this is special."
"Really?
You prick."
"In fact, Mr. Corey, I believe I had a dream about you."
"Yes, it was a dream and a feeling. A presence, actually."
"No kidding. Were we having fun?"
"You were trying to capture me, but I was more clever and much faster than you."
"I had just the opposite dream. Hey, I'd really like to meet you and buy you a drink. You sound like a fun guy."
"I don't drink."
"You don't drink alcohol. You drink blood."
He laughed.
"Yes, in fact, I licked the blood of General Wycliffe."
"You're a mentally deranged camel fucker, you know that?"
He thought about that and said,
"Perhaps we will meet before I leave.
That would be very nice.
How can I reach you?"
I gave him my number at the ATTF and said, "Call anytime. If I'm not in, leave a message and I'll get back to you."
"And your home number?"
"You don't need that. I'm at work most of the time."
"And please tell Mr. Rahman someone will be calling on him,
and the same to Mr. Wiggins."
"You can forget that sport. And by the way, when I catch up with you, I'm going to kick your balls into your mouth and rip your head off and shit down your neck."
"We'll see who catches who, Mr. Corey. And my regards to Miss Mayfield. Have a good day."
"Your mother was fucking Gaddafi. That's why Muammar had your father killed in Paris, you stupid."
The line was dead, and I stood there a while trying to get myself together. The room was really quiet. Finally, Tom said, "You did a nice job."
Yeah. I walked out of the living room, into the TV room to where I had spotted a bar and poured myself a few inches of scotch. I took a deep breath and drank it all. Kate came into the room and asked softly, "You okay?" "I will be soon. Want a drink?" "Yes, but no thanks." I poured another and stared off into space. Kate said, "I think we can go now."
"Go where?"
"We'll find a motel and stay in Ventura, then check in tomorrow with the LA office. I still know some people there, and I'd like you to meet them."
I didn't reply.
She said, "Then I'll show you around LA if you want, then back to New York."
I said, "He's here. He's very close to here."
"I know. So we'll stay around a few days and see what develops.
I want all car rental agencies checked. I want the Libyan community turned upside down. All ports of departure watched. The Mexican border under tight..."
"John, we know all of that. It's in the works right now, same as New York."
I sat down and sipped my scotch.
"Damn it. Look, we saved Wigan's life."
I stood. "I'm going to sweat Ramon a little more.
He doesn't know anything more, and you know it."
I sat again and finished my scotch.
"Yeah, well, I guess I'm out of ideas."
I looked at her.
"What do you think?"
"I think it's time to leave these people to their work. Let's go."
I stood.
"Do you think they'll let us play with a goo gun?"
She laughed, the kind of laugh that's more a sigh of relief when someone you like is getting weird than gets back to normal.
I said, "Okay, let's blow this place."
We went back into the living room to wrap it up and say goodnight. Ramon had disappeared somewhere, and everyone was looking a little down. Tom said to Kate and me, "I called Chuck to give you a lift to a motel." Just then, Tom's cell phone rang, and everyone became quiet. He put the phone to his ear and listened, then said,
"Okay.
Okay, no, don't stop him. We'll handle it here." He hung up and said to us, "Elwood Wiggins is coming home." He added, "Lady in the car with him." Tom said to everyone, "We'll all stay here in the living room and let Mr. Wiggins and his friend enter his house through the garage or the front door. When he sees us..."
"We all yell surprise," I suggested.
Tom actually smiled and said, "Bad idea. I will put him at ease and explain the situation." I hate it when they faint or bolt out the door. Half the time they think you're bill collectors. Anyway, I didn't need to be around for this interesting moment, but then I decided I'd like to meet Chip Wiggins, just to satisfy my curiosity and see what he looked and sounded like. God, I'm convinced, looks after his most clueless and carefree creations. A few minutes later, we could hear a car pull up in the driveway. The garage door opened, then closed, followed by the kitchen door opening. Then a light went on in the kitchen. We could hear Mr. Wiggins rummaging around the kitchen and opening the refrigerator. Finally, he said to his lady friend, "Hey, where did all this food come from?" Then, "Whose baseball hats are these?" "Hey, Sue, these hats say FBI.
Sue said, "I think someone was in here, Chip."
"What was your first clue, sweetheart?"
"Yeah," Chip agreed, maybe wondering if he had the right house. We waited patiently for Mr. Wiggins to come into the living room.
He said, "Stay here. I'll check it out." Chip Wiggins walked into his living room and stopped dead in his tracks. Tom said, "Please don't be alarmed." He held up his badge case. "FBI. Chip Wiggins looked at the four men and four women standing in his living room. He said,
"What?"
Chip was wearing jeans, a t-shirt, and hiking boots and looked fairly tan and fit and younger than his age. Everyone in California looks tan and fit and young, except people like me who were just passing through. Tom said, "Mr. Wiggins, we'd like to talk to you for a few minutes."
"Hey, what's this about?"
The lady friend peeked around the door jamb and said, "Chip, what's happening?" Chip explained to her where the FBI hats had come from. After about a minute or so, Chip was seated, the lady was escorted into the TV room by Edie, and Chip was relaxed but curious.
The lady, by the way, was a knockout, but I didn't notice. Tom began by saying, Mr. Wiggins, this matter concerns the bombing mission you participated in on April 15, 1986. Oh, shit. We took the liberty of entering your house based on information that a Libyan terrorist, oh, shit, was in the area and was looking to harm you. Oh, shit. We have the situation under control, but I'm afraid we're going to ask you to take some time off from work and take a vacation. Huh? This man is still at large. Shit. Tom gave Chip some of the background, then said, I'm afraid we have some bad news for you. Some of your squadron mates have been murdered.
What?
Killed by this man, Assad Khalil. Tom gave Chip a photograph of Khalil, which he encouraged Chip to look at and to keep. Chip stared at the photograph, put it down, and said, Who was killed? Tom replied, General Wycliffe and his wife. Oh, my God. Terry is dead? And Gail? Yes, sir. I'm sorry. Also, Paul Gray, William Satherwaite, and James McCoy.
Oh, my God. Oh, shit. Oh.
And, as you may know, Colonel Hambrecht was murdered in England in January. Chip got himself under control, and the realization dawned on him that he'd had a close call with a Grim Reaper.
Holy shit.
He stood and looked around as if trying to spot a terrorist. He said, Where is this guy? We're trying to apprehend him, Tom assured Chip. We can stay here tonight with you, though I don't think he'll show up here, or we'll wait until you pack and escort you. I'm out of here. Fine. Chip Wiggins stood in deep thought for a moment, perhaps the deepest thinking he'd done in some time, and said, You know, I always knew. I mean, I told Bill that day, after we'd released and were heading back, I told him those bastards weren't going to let that one go.
Oh, shit.
Bill is dead? Yes, sir. And Bob? Bob Callum? He's under close protection. I spoke up and said to Chip, Why don't you go visit him?
Yeah.
Good idea. He's at the Air Force Academy?
Yes, sir, I said.
We can keep an eye on both of you there. And it's cheaper that way. Well, no use hanging around, so Kate and I made our farewells while Chip went off to pack. He looked like the kind of guy who'd loan you a pair of underwear, but he had enough on his mind. Kate and I went outside and stood in the balmy air waiting for Chuck. Kate observed, Chip Wiggins is a very lucky man.
No kidding. Did you see that babe?
Why do I even try to talk to you?
Sorry.
I thought a moment, then said, Why did he need the rifle?
Who?
Oh, you mean Khalil?
Yeah, Khalil. Why did he need the rifle?
We don't know it was a rifle.
Let's say it was. Why did he need the rifle?
Not to kill Chip in his house.
That's true. But maybe he wanted to kill him someplace else, in the woods.
No, this guy is up and personal. I know he talks to his victims before he kills them. Why does he need the rifle?
To kill someone he can't get close to. Someone he doesn't need to talk to.
I think you have a point there.
The car came and we got in. Me in front, Kate in the back, Chuck at the wheel.
He said, Tough break. You want a good motel?
Sure, with mirrors on the ceiling.
Someone behind me smacked my head.
So off we went toward the ocean, where Chuck said there were a few nice motels with an ocean view. I asked Chuck, Is there an all-night drive-through underwear place in the area?
A what?
You know, like California has all these all-night drive-through places. I wondered if...
Kate said, John, shut up. Chuck, ignore him.
As we drove, Chuck and Kate talked about logistics and scheduling for the next day. I was thinking about Mr. Assad Khalil and our conversation. I was trying to put myself into his disturbed mind, trying to think what I'd do next if I were him. The one thing I was sure of was that Assad Khalil was not heading home. We would hear from him again.
soon. Chapter 49.
Chuck made a call from his cell phone and reserved us two rooms at a place called the Ventura Inn on the beach. He used my credit card number, got the reduced government rate, and assured me it was a reimbursable expense. Chuck handed a small paper bag to Kate and said, "I stopped and got you a toothbrush and toothpaste. If you need anything else, we can stop." "This is fine."
"What did you get me?"
I asked. He produced another paper bag from under his seat and handed it to me, saying, "I got you some nails to chew on." Chuckle, chuckle. I opened the bag and found toothpaste, toothbrush, a razor, and a travel-size can of shaving cream.
"Thanks."
"On the government."
"I'm overwhelmed."
"Right." I put the stuff in my jacket pockets. Within 10 minutes, we reached a high-rise building whose marquee announced itself as the Ventura Inn Beach Resort. Chuck pulled up to the reception doors and said, "Our office will be staffed all night, so if you need anything, give a call." I said to Chuck, "If anything pops, make sure you call us, or I'll be very, very angry."
"You're the man, John."
Tom was impressed with how you got that delivery guy to voluntarily cooperate. I said a little psychology goes a long way. "To tell you the truth, there's a lot of lotus eaters out here. It's good to see a meat-eating dinosaur once in a while."
"Is that a compliment?"
"Sort of. So what time do you want to be picked up in the morning?" Kate replied, 7:30. Chuck waved and drove off. I said to her, "Are you crazy? That's 4:30 in the morning, New York time."
"It's 10:30 a.m. New York time."
"Are you sure?"
She ignored me and walked into the motel lobby. I followed. It was a pleasant place, and I could hear a piano playing through the lounge door. The check-in guy greeted us warmly and informed us that he had deluxe ocean view rooms for us on the 12th floor. Nothing too grand for the guardians of Western civilization. I asked him, "What ocean?"
"Pacific, sir."
"Do you have anything overlooking the Atlantic?"
He smiled. Kate and I filled out the registration forms, and the guy made an impression of my American Express card, which I think let out a groan as it passed through the machine. Kate took a photo out of her bag along with her credentials and said to the clerk, "Have you seen this man?" The clerk seemed less happy than he'd been when he thought we were just passing through for the night. He stared at the photo of Asad Khalil, then replied, "No, ma'am." Kate said, "Keep that. Call us if you see him." She added, "He's wanted for murder." The clerk nodded and put the photo behind the counter. Kate told him, "Pass it on to your relief person." We got our key cards and I suggested a drink in the lounge. Kate said, "I'm exhausted. I'm going to sleep."
"It's only 10.
"It's 1 a.m. in New York. I'm tired." I had this sudden unhappy thought that I was going to drink alone and sleep alone. We went to the elevators and rode up in silence. At about the 10th floor, Kate asked me, "Are you sulking?"
"Yes."
The elevator reached the top floor and we got out. Kate said, "Well, I don't want you to sulk. Come into my room for a drink." So we went into her room, which was big, and with no luggage to unpack, we quickly made 2 scotch and sodas from the minibar and retired to the balcony. She said, "Let's forget the case tonight."
"Okay."
We sat in the 2 chairs with a round table between us and contemplated the moonlit ocean. This somehow reminded me of my convalescent stay at my uncle's house on the water on eastern Long Island. It reminded me of the night Emma and I sat drinking cognac after a skinny dip in the bay. I was sliding into a bad mood and tried to get out of it. Kate asked me, "What are you thinking about?"
"Life."
"Not a good idea." She said, "Did it ever occur to you that you're in this business, working long, hard hours, because you don't want to have the time to think about your life?"
"Please,
listen to me. I really care for you, and I sense that you're looking for something. Clean underwear. You can wash your fucking underwear." "I never thought of that."
"Look, John, I'm 31 years old, and I've never come close to getting married.
I can't imagine why.
Well, for your information, it wasn't for lack of offers.
Gotcha.
Do you think you'd get married again?
How far a fall do you think it is from this balcony?
I thought she'd get angry over my flippancy, but instead she laughed.
Sometimes a guy can do no right, sometimes a guy can do no wrong.
It has nothing to do with what a guy does. It has to do with a woman.
Kate said to me, "Anyway, you did a hell of a job today. I'm impressed.
I even learned a few things."
"Good. When you ram your knee into a guy's balls from that position, you may actually pop his nuts into his abdomen, so you have to be careful."
Smart lady that she was, she said, "I don't think you're a violent or sadistic man. I think you do what you have to do when you have to do it. And I think you don't like it. That's important."
See what I mean?
I could do no wrong in Kate's eyes.
She'd put two more little bottles of scotch in her jacket pocket, and she opened them and poured them in our glasses. After a minute or so, she said,
"I know about that thing that happened on Plum Island."
"What thing?"
"When you disemboweled that guy."
I took a deep breath, but didn't reply.
She let a few seconds pass, then said, "We all have a dark side. It's okay."
"Actually, I enjoyed it."
"No, you didn't."
"No, I didn't. But there were extenuating circumstances."
"I know. You killed someone you cared for very much."
"Let's drop the subject."
"Sure.
But I wanted you to know that I understand what happened and why."
"Good. I'll try not to do that again."
"See what I mean?
I cut this guy's guts out and it's okay.
Actually, it was okay, because he deserved it."
Anyway, we let that subject cool off a while. We drank and stared at the mesmerizing ocean rolling toward the beach. You could hear the waves breaking softly against the shore.
"What a view."
A breeze passed by, and I could smell the sea. I asked her, "You liked it here?"
"California is nice. The people are very friendly."
People often mistake spacey for friendly, but why ruin her memory?
"Did you have a boyfriend here?"
"Sort of."
She asked me, "Do you want my sexual history?"
"How long will that take?"
"Less than an hour."
I smiled.
She asked me, "Was your divorce nasty?"
"Not at all. The marriage was nasty."
"Why did you marry her?"
"She asked me."
"Can't you say no?"
"Well, I thought I was in love. Actually, she was an ADA, and we were on the side of the angels. Then she took a high-powered job as a criminal defense attorney. She changed."
"No, she didn't. The job changed. Could you be a criminal defense attorney? Could you be a criminal?"
"I see your point.
But..."
"And she made a lot more money defending criminals than you did arresting them."
"Money had nothing to do with..."
"I'm not saying what she does for a living is wrong. I'm saying that..."
"What's her name?"
"Robin."
"Robin was not right for you even when she was an assistant district attorney."
"Good point. Can I jump now, or is there more you need to tell me?"
"There is. Hold on. So you meet Beth Penrose, who's on the same side of the law that you're on, and you're reacting against your ex-wife. You feel comfortable with a cop, maybe less guilty.
I'm sure it was no fun around the station house being married to a criminal defense attorney."
"I think that's enough."
"Actually, it's not. Then I came along. Perfect trophy, right? FBI, attorney, your boss."
"Stop right there. Let me remind you that it was you."
"Forget it."
"Are you angry?"
"You're damn right I'm angry."
I stood.
"I gotta go."
She stood.
"All right, go.
But you have to face some realities, John. You can't hide behind that tough guy, wise-ass exterior forever. Someday, maybe soon, you're going to retire, and then you have to live with the real John Corey. No gun, no badge. Shield. No one to arrest. No one who needs you to protect them or to protect society. It'll just be you, and you don't even know who you are. Neither do you. This is California psychobabble bullshit, and you've only been here since 7:30. Good night. I left the balcony, left her room, and went out into the corridor. I found my room next door and went in. I kicked off my shoes, threw my jacket on the bed, and took off my holster, shirt, tie, and armored vest. Then I made a drink from the minibar. I was pretty worked up and actually felt like crap. I mean, I knew what Kate was doing, and I knew it wasn't malicious, but I really didn't need to be prodded into confronting the monster in the mirror. Ms. Mayfield, if I'd given her a few more minutes, would have painted a beautiful picture of how life could be if we were facing it together. Women think the perfect husband is all they need for a perfect life. Wrong. First, there are no perfect husbands, not even many good ones. Second, she was right about me, and I wasn't going to get any better by living with Kate Mayfield. I decided to wash my underwear, go to bed, and never see Kate Mayfield again after this case was concluded. There was a knock on my door. I looked through the peephole and opened the door. She stepped inside, and we stood there looking at each other. I can be really tough in these situations, and I didn't intend to give an inch or to kiss and make up. I didn't even feel like sex anymore. However, she was wearing a white terry cloth hotel robe, which she opened and let fall to the floor, revealing her perfect, naked body. I felt my resolve softening at the same rate Mr. Happy was getting hard. She said, "I'm sorry to bother you, but my shower doesn't work. Could I use yours?" "Help yourself." She went into my bathroom, turned on the shower, and got in. Well, I mean, what was I supposed to do? I got out of my pants, shorts, and socks and got into the shower. For purposes of propriety, in case there was a middle-of-the-night phone call from the FBI, she left my room at 1 a.m. I didn't sleep particularly well and woke up at 5:15, which I guess was 8:15 on my body clock. I went into the bathroom and saw that my undershorts were hanging on the retractable clothesline above the bathtub. They were clean, still damp, and someone had planted a lipstick kiss in a strategic spot. I shaved, showered again, brushed my teeth and all that, then went out to the balcony and stood there naked in the breeze, looking at the dark ocean. The moon had set and the sky was full of stars. It doesn't get much better than this, I decided. I stood there a long time, because it felt good. I heard the sliding glass door on the other side of the concrete partition open. I called out, "Good morning." I heard her reply, "Good morning." The partition jutted out beyond the balcony, so I couldn't peek around. I asked her, "Are you naked?" "Yes." "Are you?" "Of course. This feels great." "Meet me for breakfast in half an hour." "Okay. Hey, thanks for washing my shorts." "Don't get used to it." We were talking sort of loud, and I had the feeling other guests were listening. I think she had the same thought because she said, "What did you say your name was?"
"John."
"Right. You're a good lay, John."
"Thanks. You too."
So there we were, two mature federal agents standing naked on hotel balconies with a partition between us, acting silly the way new lovers act. She called out, "Are you married?"
"No. How about you?"
"No."
So what was my next line?
Two simultaneous thoughts ran through my head. One, that I was being manipulated by a pro. Two, I loved it. Realizing that this moment and this setting was going to be remembered forever, I took a deep breath and asked, "Will you marry me?" There was a long silence. Finally, a woman's voice, not Kate's, called out from overhead, "Answer him!" Kate called out,
Okay, I'll marry you. Two people somewhere applauded. This was really dopey. I think I was actually embarrassed, which barely masked my sense of panic. What had I done? I heard her sliding door close, so I couldn't qualify my proposal. I went into my room, got dressed, sans body armor, and went downstairs to the breakfast room where I got coffee and a copy of the New York Times hot off the press. There was continuing coverage of the Flight 175 tragedy, but it seemed like a rehash of events with a few new quotes from federal, state, and local officials. There was a small paragraph about Mr. Leibowitz's murder in Frankfurt and an obituary. He lived in Manhattan and had a wife and two children. It struck me again how random life could be. The guy goes to Frankfurt for business and gets clipped because some people need a red herring to make it look like a guy in America on a secret mission is back in Europe. Whack. Just like that, without regard to the victim's wife, kids, or anything. These people sucked. There was also a little rehash of the double murder of James McCoy and William Satherwaite at the Cradle of Aviation Museum. A Nassau homicide detective was quoted as saying, "We're not ruling out the possibility that the motive for these murders may not have been robbery." Despite the tortured syntax, I could see that little Alan Parker was spooning out a third today, a third tomorrow, and the rest by the weekend. Speaking of tortured syntax, I turned to Janet Maslin's movie review column. Some days I do the Times crossword puzzle, other days I try to understand what Ms. Maslin is trying to say. I can't do both on the same day without getting a headache. Ms. Maslin was reviewing a box office smash, an action-adventure mid-East terrorist flick of all things, which I think she didn't like, but as I say, it's hard to follow her prose or her reasoning. The movie was lowbrow, of course, and Ms. Maslin may think of herself as highbrow, but somebody from the Times had to go see this thing and tell everybody who loved it why it sucked. I made a mental note to see the movie. Kate arrived and I stood and we pecked. We sat and looked at the menus and I thought perhaps she'd forgotten the silly incident on the balconies. But then she put down her menu and asked, "When?" June? Okay. The waitress came by and we both ordered pancakes. I really wanted to read the Times, but I instinctively knew that my breakfast newspaper was a thing of the past. We chatted briefly about the plans for the day, the case, the people we'd met at Chip Wiggin's house, and who I was going to be introduced to by Kate later in L.A. The pancakes came and we ate. Kate said, "You'll like my father." "I'm sure I will. He's about your age, maybe a little older." "Well, that's good." I remembered a line from an old movie and said, "He raised a swell daughter." "He did, my sister." I chuckled. She said, "You're like my mother, too." "Are you and she alike?" "No, she's nice." I chuckled again. She said, "Is it all right if we get married in Minnesota? I have a big family." "Great. Minnesota. Is that a city or a state?" "I'm a Methodist. How about you?" "Any kind of birth control is fine." "My religion. Methodist. Oh, my mother's Catholic. My father's some kind of Protestant. They never..." "Then we can raise the children in a Protestant denomination." "You have kids?" "This is important, John. Pay attention." "I am. I'm trying to, you know, shift gears." She stopped eating and looked at me. "Are you totally panicked?" "No, of course not." "You look panicky." "Just a little stomach acid. Comes with age." "This is going to be all right. We are going to live happily ever after." "Good. But you know, we haven't known each other that long." "We will by June," she said. "Right. Good point. Do you love me?" "Actually, I do, but love..." "What if I got up and walked out of here? How would you feel? Relieved?" "No, I'd feel awful." "So? Why are you fighting how you feel?"
Are we about to go into analysis again?
No, I'm just telling you like it is. I'm madly in love with you. I want to marry you. I want to have children with you. What else do you want me to say?
Say, I love New York in June. I hate New York, but for you, I'll live anywhere.
New Jersey?
Don't push it.
Time for full disclosure. So I said, look, Kate, you should know that I'm a male chauvinist pig, a misogynist, and I tell sexist jokes.
Your point is?
I saw I wasn't getting anywhere with this line of reasoning, so I said, also, I have a bad attitude toward authority, and I'm